I hope you enjoy this talk. These talks are always offered freely so that no one is ever denied access to these teachings, and your support really makes a big difference. Dana is the ancient Pali word for spontaneous generosity of heart. If you feel inspired to support these talks by offering Dana, you can do so by visiting my website at www.mindfulvalley.com. Thank you so much. So some of you have heard this before, but I think it's been a couple of years. I wanted to talk about the Heartwood Sutta, and I've really been digging into the suttas lately, so you'll probably hear more suttas this year, I suspect. Sutta, sutra. A few years ago, there was a highly promoted launch of something called the International Mindfulness Teachers Association, and this was designed to be the first organization dedicated to professionalizing and standardizing the growing field of people who are teaching meditation. And the organizers explained that they were launching this new certifying organization as a way to distinguish those teachers who have gone through more extensive accredited teacher training with national and international teachers, and those, for instance, who might teach the practice but haven't gone through a lot of training or maybe even have a lot of experience in it. Now, this doesn't mean that you can't learn something from someone who doesn't have a lot of experience in the practice. You can absolutely learn what they've learned and how they understand it. And the truth is, all of us who are teachers can only ever teach what we know, right? And how we understand it. That's just the deal. Depending on what we've been taught, who we've studied with, and how long we've been studying or practicing. So in our own practice, a question that we can really ask ourselves is, how deep do I want or plan to go? No. What am I looking for here? Truly, what am I looking for? It's a good question to ask yourself. It's actually an incredibly important question, right? To really be aware of this and honest about our answers. You know, sometimes we just aren't honest with ourselves about our answers. And so maybe we ask ourselves that question, and the answer is, you know what? I don't really want to go that deep. And honestly, that's completely okay and perfect. You know, maybe you're just looking for a kind of simple technique that's going to help you to relax or calm down or sleep a little easier at night. And if that's what you're looking for, you're in luck, because there are many, many people who can teach these basic techniques. But maybe you ask yourself that question and you find that you want to go a little deeper than that. And maybe you also want to learn to be more kind to yourself or have better relationships with yourself and the world. So you might go a little further and start reading more about the practice or going on retreats here and there or looking around for a more skilled teacher who can help you with these things. But if you find that this still isn't as satisfying as you would like, and you are inspired to discover a deeper, more permanent transformation, and put even more effort and energy and commitment into your practice, then you're really going to want to find a more qualified teacher or teachers who can take you there. And honestly, I'm fully aware that the majority of people that I end up speaking in front of in various settings outside of the Sangha and some of my longer retreats just want to learn about that first part, which is to find a little more peace in their lives, right? And a way to relax. And honestly, that calming aspect of the practice, the shamatha, part of the shamatha vipassana practice, is so needed. It really is, especially right now in our world that seems so chaotic. So I love teaching that part, and I used to do it for years, you know, with the MBSR, that was the really foundational shamatha part of practice. And it's often actually what I focus on whenever I'm with a group of newcomers, because learning this can be so beneficial and something to hold on to. But as a confession, whenever I come home from one of these type of shorter classes, like I did a few weeks ago when I led a two-hour walk up at Blandy Farm, my husband Brent always teases me about not fully telling the newcomers the entire truth of the practice and what's really involved. And one of our great modern insight meditation teachers, many of you may know Bhante Gunaratana, Bhante G, now in his 90s, he describes it this way, which I love. He says, somewhere in this meditation process, you will come face to face with the sudden and shocking realization that you are completely crazy. He says, your mind is a shrieking, gibbering madhouse on wheels, barreling pell-mell down the hill, utterly out of control and hopeless. No problem. He says, you are not crazier than you were yesterday. It has always been this way, and you just never noticed. That's what's really involved. And I would tell people that, though. Nobody would come. So, to those of you who have continued to come out here for years, months at a time to practice, even though you've discovered that you're indeed crazy, I'm bowing deeply to your courage. Really, truly, you are all beautiful, spiritual, brave, fierce bodhisattvas, you know, willing to look at your own crazy mind and see it for what it is and keep coming back for more. Okay? And so this is really what I want to talk about tonight, which is the process of going deeper in our practice to find more freedom. And as a way of doing this, I'm going to explore a very famous Buddha Sutta, as I said, the Maha Saropama Sutta, the Greater Discourse on the Simile of the Heartwood, which is more commonly known as the Heartwood Sutta, very famous sutta. And the Buddha said that the spiritual life was like a great tree standing in the middle of a forest. And so you might imagine, we were at Claymont, there was something called a grandmother tree. It's huge. Everyone goes to see it. So I always think of that tree, like a huge, enormous tree. And you might imagine all the different branches and the twigs and the leaves and the outer bark and the inner bark and the sapwood and all the different rings that have developed over maybe hundreds of years, right, on this great tree. And then finally, you might imagine this tree's heartwood, which is the densest, hardest, most durable part of the tree, the part that doesn't shake when the wind blows, you know, that part that is strongly rooted, unmovable, unshakable, okay, unshakable. And in the sutta, the Buddha says that sometimes people can mistake all the various parts of the tree, the spiritual path, for the heartwood. And so very sadly, people end up walking away from the practice, or maybe not going any deeper, without ever discovering the best part of it, which is that part that is unshakable. So I'll read you the first part of the sutta so you can hear the refrain that runs through the whole thing. I really would like you to hear this. So if you want to close your eyes, you can even. Suppose a man needing, or woman, suppose a person needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, came to a great tree standing possessed of heartwood. Passing over its heartwood, its sapwood, its inner bark, and its outer bark, they would cut off its twigs and leaves and take them away thinking they were heartwood. Then a person with good sight, seeing this, might say, this good person did not know the heartwood, the sapwood, the inner bark, the outer bark, or the twigs and leaves. Thus, while needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, they came to a great tree standing possessed of heartwood, and passing over its heartwood, its sapwood, its inner bark, and its outer bark, they cut off its twigs and leaves and took them away, thinking that they were heartwood. Whatever it was this good person had to make with heartwood, their purpose will not be served. This bhikkhu is called one who has taken the twigs and leaves of the holy life and stopped short with that. Being heedless, they dwell in suffering and stress. And so that same phrasing repeats itself throughout the sutta, and as it goes along, it does this with all the different parts and rings of the tree that are mistaken for the heartwood. It goes through this. And the Buddha uses the rings as a simile to describe all those places in practice when people walk away from it thinking, this is it, I've got it. Or when they're mistaken about what they're actually carrying away from the practice. And there are many, many places in our practice where we can do this. But in this sutta, the Buddha talks about five different layers of this tree. And so I'm going to go through these five briefly tonight. And again, I'm going to start by reading you the first part of the sutta, which again repeats itself in some form throughout. And here the Buddha is speaking to his students, the monks and nuns, about a clansman who has gone forth. Whenever you hear that term, gone forth in the practice, it means a person of a certain family or clan that has left their regular secular life to go into homelessness as a monk to pursue the spiritual life. They've gone forth. So the Buddha, addressing his students, says, bhikkhus, here some clansman goes forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness, considering I am a victim of birth, aging, and death, of sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. I am a victim of suffering, a prey to suffering. Surely an end of this whole mass of suffering can be known. When they have gone forth thus, they acquire gain, honor, and renown. They are pleased with that gain, honor, and renown, and their intention is fulfilled. On account of it, they laud themselves and despair others thus. I have gain, honor, and renown, but these other bhikkhus are unknown, of no account. They become intoxicated with that gain, honor, and renown, grow negligent, fall into negligence, and being negligent, they live in suffering. So in this first section, the Buddha is saying that this monk has mistaken what he calls gain, honor, and renown for the heartwood, but has only really taken the twigs and leaves off this great, mighty tree. Okay? So these twigs and leaves are often considered the simple benefits of the practice, and they can sometimes be really deceptive. Okay? So for instance, the gains we might experience might include things like pleasant body sensations or experiences, you know, being able to achieve more calm and ease and relaxation. That feels good, right? Maybe we're able to sit for longer and longer periods of time. Or maybe we notice that we can better control our anger or our negative reactions more often, okay? And these benefits might also then include a sense of discovering a little more self-esteem, feeling proud of ourselves for how much we practice or how long or how much our practice seems to be working. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that, to be proud of yourself. We all need to honor these gains and benefits of practice in order to encourage ourselves to continue, of course, when the going gets rough, which it will. Just like the tree, if you'll stick with me, we need those twigs and leaves, right? The problem is we can often misunderstand what we're holding when we acquire these twigs and leaves. And the first misunderstanding is that sometimes we start believing that these physical sensations or abilities and the increased confidence we feel in ourselves is the heartwood itself, And what happens is we become complacent in our practice. Like, ah, this is it. The truth is, whenever we're caught up in the twigs and leaves, often what we're really entangled in is a sense of ego gratification, is actually what it is. So at this point, the practice is more about self than other. And sometimes this can even lead to strengthening rather than humbling the ego or a sense of self. And of course, sometimes it can actually create a lot of harm and suffering, okay, when it gets into self. Just as a for instance, sadly, it's been a lot lately, if you're caught up in the Buddhist world, some popular Buddhist monks and teachers today have found themselves really caught up in their own fame and honor and renown, and have latched on to this identity of themselves as gurus, and have forgotten that the teachings should always be more important than the teacher. Always. Right? And this was obviously true in the Buddha's time too, because he was aware of this very human tendency, and he was really clear about this, and he urged his students strongly, do not idolize me. Don't do it. He said, it's like when someone points his finger at the moon to show it to someone else. Guided by the finger, that person should see the moon. If he looks at the finger instead and mistakes it for the moon, he loses not only the moon, but the finger also. Why? It is because he mistakes the pointing finger for the bright moon. I love that. A lesser extreme of this tendency to grasp at, quote, fame, honor, and renown is when we start to identify as a meditator or even a Buddhist, right? It becomes a kind of an identity or something we can maybe boast to our friends, right? It's an identity. You'll notice it. It's caught up in ego. A few years ago, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I was teaching at one of the MBSR workshops. And at the end, one of my students who happened to be a single doctor, and he was joking at the end of the class that the workshop really raised his sexiness factor because he could now boast to the women that he met that he meditated 1 hour a day, every day. That raised his sexiness factor. I think the statistics are it's just about 25% men. And we look around here, it's probably true. So you guys have your sexiness factor raised. Woohoo! So I like how Lama Soni writes about this tendency of ours. He writes, we all enter the spiritual path as ego-based beings. And as such, we have ego-based hopes and fears. Practice is virtually never what we expect. We feel like we've got it all wrong, thinking, the more I meditate, the worse I become. And then he says, my teacher, Gendun Rinpoche, always responded to this by saying, when you see your own shortcomings, it's the dawn of qualities. If you only see your qualities, there's a problem. Want me to read that again? He said, when you see your own shortcomings, it's the dawn of qualities. If you only see your qualities, there's a problem. Yeah, really wise. And just as encouragement, so we don't beat up on ourselves, please remember that this is something we all do. We all do it. And at some point, maybe even often, we tend to become very pleased with ourselves and our practice. Okay? We all do it. And again, it's important to remember that having confidence is really okay. We all need those twigs and leaves. But as the Buddha reminds us, it's also helpful to remember these are only the smallest parts of this very giant tree. Okay? So as we continue to stay with the practice, somewhere along the way, we discover that it's become less about self and more about self and other. More about connection and service. And what happens is that the more clearly we begin to see into our own hearts and minds, the more aware we become of how we might be harming ourselves and others with our own old, unskillful thoughts and behaviors. Okay, see this much more clearly. And as this continues, it sort of organically leads us to become more and more concerned with how we can bring less harm and more joy into our world and to others. Less harm and more joy. How can we do it? Our focus becomes that rather than more focused on self. And so at this stage, we're truly beginning to understand the beauty of what is called sila, or moral discipline or conduct, and become even more dedicated to practicing it, because we can just see how much joy it brings, right? Sila, you know, moral conduct brings joy. And not because some authority has told us what's right or wrong, right? But because we know it, and we have true integrity because of our own close investigation into our own mind, body, heart. That's what we're doing with the practice, right? And the Buddha says when we've reached this point in our practice, we have started to touch the outer bark when we've reached this stage. Okay? And yet, even here, we can sometimes mistake this outer bark as the heartwood, and we might even use it in a way that it again, is a little bit harmful, or maybe very harmful. For instance, sometimes we can practice sila in a way that is rule-based, right? Or self-disciplinary, or harsh, right? Or using it as some kind of a self-improvement project, right? Think about that, all that we get into the rules. Rather than leading from the heart and offering ourselves and others compassion and forgiveness. We also might use it as a way to become a bit self-righteous and look down on others who aren't following the precepts, right? Like, what? You're still eating meat, you know? Yeah. That kind of thing sometimes I hear on retreats. There's a famous story from the Zen tradition, many of you may have heard, that speaks to this. It's about two Buddhist monks who are on their way back to their monastery after a trip to a nearby village. And on their way home, they have to cross a river. And when they reach the river, they see this woman in the water who's struggling, and she's about to drown, this woman. And one of the monks, of course, immediately jumps into the water, and he carries the woman back to shore and saves her life. And after they've, you know, comforted her and safely seen her on her way, the two monks start walking home together. But the monk who didn't jump into the water is being really quiet and sullen. And finally, this monk says to the other, and he's, you know, upset, he says, you know, you broke your vow to never touch a woman when you carried her out of the river back there. I can't believe your monk's vows mean so little to you. It's really bummed, you know. And the first monk replies, at least I set her down on the shore. You are still carrying her. I love that story. It's a good one. So as we continue more and more to live a life that is filled with integrity and moral conduct, and begin to let go of what are called the defilements and the hindrances that poison our practice and our lives, what happens is that we begin to experience more joy and tranquility in our lives. And we begin to live with more awareness and grace and kindness and compassion and joy and ease, which, of course, are the four Brahmaviharas, the divine abodes. And because we're living with less disruptive mind states and behaviors, what happens is that gradually we start more and more to experience more samadhi or concentration. And we start to enter the jhanas or the bliss states more and more. And this process is called samadhi bhavana, the development of samadhi. And these states can often feel incredibly divine, you know, blissful, the divine states. And so much so that Sayadaw Upendhita has called them fake nirvana, because they often masquerade as enlightenment. And so what can happen is that when we find ourselves sometimes in these very strong states of blissful concentration, we can often believe that we've reached or achieved some kind of permanent peace. This is it. You know, got it. And one of my favorite teachers, Larry Rosenberg, who founded the Cambridge Insight Meditation Center, wrote a story about this stage in our development. And he said, I was up at the Insight Meditation Society on a self-retreat, meditating in my room at about 11:30 in the morning. It was roughly the middle of the retreat. In that particular sitting, my mind got extremely still, full of joy and bliss and peace. I began to have the feeling, this is it. This is what I have been reading about for years, hoping with all my heart to achieve, full and total enlightenment. It's right around the corner. At which point, the lunch bell rang. They have a kind of gong that they ring there, which gives off a beautiful sound as the ringer walks through the halls. And without hesitating, I unfolded my legs, stood up, and walked downstairs to get my rice and vegetables. It was only afterwards that I said to myself, hey, wait a minute. No matter how you look at that story, one fact is clear. I preferred a good meal to enlightenment. If none of you have studied with Larry before, he has a wonderful book called Breath by Breath, and I want to recommend it. It's on my reading list, but it's very good. He's very funny. So in the Heartwood Sutta, the Buddha tells us that when we start to experience these strong states of concentration and bliss, we've still only touched the outer bark of this great tree. And just as with all the other rings of this great tree, we can sometimes be misdirected or led astray from the path by getting stuck in the bliss states. A lot of people get stuck there, you know, or get obsessed with achieving the bliss states or the different jhanas, you know, which is just another way of building ego, you know. Sometimes when I go on longer retreats, I'm always amazed afterwards, when everybody's talking, to hear people bragging about what jhana states they've been in. You know, it's like, wait a minute, aren't we supposed to be letting go of ego here? You know? Especially if the topic of the retreat was on anatta, of no self, you know? And so here, at this stage, whenever we start entering states of bliss, you know, you might make an effort to notice all the ways that you might be believing, even during that sit, in a kind of fake nirvana, and how you might actually be turning away from your crazy mind, if you will, by going away into the bliss states, which is really common, okay? But it's just, it's going away. It's not wanting to be with yourself. And as we all know, this whole practice is about not turning away from your crazy mind, not turning away from anything, right? It's all about turning towards ourselves and our lives, you know, looking deeply into the nature of our minds to really see them clearly, okay? What we are practicing when we're practicing Vipassana insight is, and actually Vipassana is a Pali word, and its definition is to see things as they really are. That's the definition of the Vipassana, to see things as they really are. And so the stages of concentration and calm, shamatha, are really important, because as we continue to be able to allow our minds to become more settled and concentrated in those states, what happens is that we can more clearly see into them. That's why we have those states. We want to see into the mind. And when we start to more closely examine our own minds, mind, body, heart, and really start to know experientially, not intellectually, but in our own mind, body, heart, we'll start to see the truth of the three characteristics, and we'll know them experientially. And these three characteristics, as a review, you guys know what these are? Anybody? Right? So the three truths or characteristics of life are anicca, impermanence, right? Anatta, no self, and dukkha. There is suffering, those three. They're all connected. So we see these more clearly experientially. And as we continue in our practice, what happens is that instead of these truths being something that we struggle with or run away from in fear, we start to learn how to ride the waves of these truths and life itself. Okay? And in return, as we start to get to know the three characteristics more experientially, we start experiencing deeper and deeper levels of peace and balance and ease, and we start to get a very sweet taste of the fruit of our practice, which is equanimity, right? The fruit of the practice. And at this stage, we start experiencing a more natural sense of ease by acknowledging more and more and more, this is it. Kathy's got it, just recently got a new tattoo. This is it. You know? This is the life we're living, which is a constant stream of pleasant and unpleasant, what are called the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. We just want the 10,000 joys, right? Want to deal with the 10,000 sorrows. And isn't it beautiful? This fleeting, precious, wonderful life, all of it, the full catastrophe, as John Kabat-Zinn writes in his book. And I'm always reminded here of my favorite cheesy movie of all time that I used to watch. I haven't watched it for a while, but I used to watch it endlessly, which is It's a Wonderful Life with Jimmy Stewart. And my favorite part is when Jimmy Stewart, of course, rejoices at the end and shouts yay at all the everything. Yay, bank examiners. Yay, wobbly knob on the banister. You know, I love that. Yay to his entire messy life. It's such a good, it's such a good Buddhist show, actually, or movie. And yet the Buddha says that even this is still not the heartwood. Even this isn't it. It's just the sapwood of the tree. And anybody in here a woodworker? I think Bruce is, yeah. Anybody else a woodworker? My husband, Brent, is a lifelong woodworker, and he attests to the fact that the sapwood of the tree can often appear like the heartwood, but it isn't, because it's still softer, and it's still prone to insects and decay. Okay? But it appears to be the heartwood, but it isn't. And the same is true of this stage in the practice. This stage in the practice, our equanimity is still impermanent. It's prone to being eaten away, if you look at it that way. So, for instance, we can still get knocked off the beam by some serious difficulty that's suddenly thrown our way and struggle and fight with the way things are, which means, of course, we suffer when we're resisting. The Buddha says we'll know when we've reached the heartwood when it becomes impossible to not forget the three characteristics of dukkha, anicca, and anatta. And he calls this knowledge or wisdom unshakable. Yeah. The Pali term for this is akupa, which literally means unprovoked. It's when we're no longer thrown off that beam because there's no beam to fall off of, right? It's that sense. When we are fully aware of the three characteristics or truths, we have, in essence, let go of clinging to anything, including a sense of a solid, permanent, reliable self, right? That's solid. We've let that go. It says, the writer Francois says, when you let go of the desire to control everything, you then really acquire control, because in that priceless moment, you experience a changeless peace, not dependent on any conditions. I'm going to read that again. When you let go of the desire to control everything, you then really acquire control, because in that priceless moment, you experience a changeless peace that is not dependent on any conditions. Okay. So as I come to a close here, I really want to emphasize that the Buddha wasn't offering us the simile to make us all feel bad, right? You know, for not being as enlightened as we'd like to, but to help us to navigate our intention and point to this heartwood as our goal, okay? And also to really encourage us to walk it, because he also said this is achievable for all of us, right? That we can discover tastes of freedom throughout, all along the way, right? It's not an end point necessarily. We can have moments of enlightenment all throughout the practice, right? That's helpful to remember. And also remember that it's not a literal map, you know, and it's not going to help us to get caught up in things like striving or comparing or trying to figure out which part of the tree we've reached, right? It's meant to be an inspiration and also serve as a caution as we continue along the path, something to be aware of and be cautious of. And even today, if you visit Thailand or Burma or some of the other Asian countries and are searching for a Buddha Rupa, which is a Buddha statue, if you're searching for one, the locals will all tell you to find one that's made of heartwood, since these are going to be the strongest and the heaviest, and they won't break as easily. Okay. And they also serve, of course, as a representation or reminder of the pith of the practice, what we're really aiming at. And so to end, I'd like to read you the final words of the Heartwood Sutta, which are, so this spiritual life does not have gain, honor, or renown for its benefit, or the attainment of moral discipline for its benefit, or the attainment of concentration for its benefit, or knowledge and vision for its benefit. But it is this unshakable liberation of mind that is the goal of the spiritual life, its heartwood and its end. So with that, I think I will invite us all into a minute or so of practice. Just breathing in deeply and then letting go. A couple of rounds of those on your own, just to get in touch with the breath again. And here I want to invite those of you who'd like to place a hand on the heart, hand on the belly. And just ask yourself a question, which is, how deep do I really want to go? How deep do I want to go? What am I looking for? Just be honest. What am I looking for? And let your heart tell you what that is, not your head. And finally, with the eyes closed, just listening to this encouragement from Ajahn Chah, the great master, who tells us, do not try to become anything. Do not make yourself into anything. Do not be a meditator. Do not become enlightened. When you sit, let it be. When you walk, let it be. Grasp at nothing. Resist nothing. If you haven't wept deeply, you haven't begun to meditate.